can go forward if you want to ventilate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. We have to make a debate on Botox versus neuromodulation, so I think it will not be a state of the art, but more question and answer. And when we prepare the topic, Paul asked us to speak about what we currently know on Botox and neuromodulation, what is the level of evidence, which recommendation we have, what further research is needed, establish which technique should be put in which treatment algorithm, and identify a patient group for different treatment. So I'm not an expert in idiopathic bladder, because I'm mainly working on neurogenic bladder. So I was looking what I was found in the literature, the actual literature, and I found this paper from Anja in the Journal of Urology, which was a systematic review between 2005 and February 2009. On what we know on Botox in overactive bladder. I have to say that at the last ICI meeting, the recommendation for idiopathic bladder was known, the grade C recommendation, and no level of evidence, because the botulinum toxin is actually off-label use. As opposed to Apostolos in the consensus paper, he was more courageous and he put level of evidence 1 and recommendation A. But that's another debate we can discuss after the presentation. So if you look at this paper, it was, I'm sorry for the quality, but at least the authors find 32 articles. The research the keywords were botulinum toxin, overactive bladder, urinary incontinence, and at least from these 32 papers, they have to exclude 359, because it was not overactive bladder, or it was a pediatric patient. From these remaining papers, they reviewed 37 abstracts, and 10 more were excluded because it was using botulinum toxin B or Dysport, or because it was a treatment, mixed treatment. So at least they found only 23 articles on botulinum toxin and idiopathic bladder, and from these 23 articles, they find 3 randomized controlled trials, and I will focus on these 3 randomized controlled trials. So what I was looking at, I have to say that the entry parameters was different in the different study, randomized controlled study. From the Brubaker study, it was mainly the patient perception improvement score, and the urinary incontinence was a secondary outcome. In the Flynn paper, it was incontinence episode on more than 2 in the voiding diary, in the daily voiding diary, and in the Sci paper, it was more than. It was mainly urgency with or without incontinence, and the tools of overactivity. But at least if you look at the pool randomized effect from the 3 study on the number of incontinence episodes, the pool random effect was 3.88, which means that the patient, the number of reduction of daily incontinence was 3, about 4 more significant, or 4 more than in the placebo groups. Then they looked at the quality of life. The three randomized control study was looking at the UDIS-6 for Flynn and Psy, and the long form of the UDI for Brubaker study. So what they found that the pool standard effect on the quality of life was 0.62, which means an improvement of 15 points. Regarding the side effects, in none of the study it was a dramatic general systemic side effect. The main systemic side effect was increase of the residual volume, but we have, after I will go more in detail about the doses of these auto have needed. Sorry. So if you see the PVR mean increase in the three study, you see that it was about the odd ratio was about 8.55, which means that the patient with botulinum toxin has a 8-fold higher risk for intermittent, for post-void residual volume. But this one I will discuss, but because different study, the level, the threshold of the post-void residual volume was different from study to study, and the consequence of the post-void residual volume was not the same in all the study. So I found this paper from Van Kroeberg. I was hoping that Philip was coming today because we could have discussed this paper, which was published recently in Neurology Internationalis. So they also look at the study for the three randomized control study, and then they was looking at the three biggest observational studies. So, but if you look at the randomized control study, you see that it's a very low group of patients, 18 above 35 year, 20, 43 in the Brubaker group. So only big study, the patient with the study with big patient was a study we performed in Zurich on idiopathic bladder. But now look at the doses, and you see that the dose is not only different, but most of the patients are using 200, we use 100. But the number of injection sites is different, and the dilution is different, because in the Psy studies they use 200 milliliters in 20 mils. In the Flynn, and I want to tell you, Stefan, that it's not 8.10, but it was 10.15 injection site, but it doesn't matter. The injection volume was 0.2 milliliter per injection site. In the Psy study, 1 milliliter per injection site. And in the Brubaker study, it was 3 mil, which means 3 mil versus 20 mil. It might be a difference in the effect, but it's more a discussion. It's more going to be discussed after. As you can see, most of the study investigator use to treat to the chooser. I am aware of one study. It was a Jack Corco study who injected idiopathic overactivity in the trigon. They didn't find a very good effect. I don't know if they published a study. What they found is actually that they cannot induce any reflux, but I'm not sure that the result, as I was speaking with Jacques, was very good on the symptoms. I was looking at the duration of clinical improvement and not as a follow-up, but a 6 month size study is because the study was lasting 6 months. In the Brubaker study, the duration of improvement, which means the perception of clinical improvement for the patient, was 307 days. But the study from Brubaker has to be stopped because of the unexpected high post-residual volume rate. So at least we have only two studies with repeat injection, which is the CASI study, with a duration of clinical improvement of about 13 months, and the Smith study with a duration of clinical improvement of 9 months, with a mean rejection of 2 and a mean rejection of 6. It is difficult to say what is the definition of how long does it is a clinical improvement, because if you speak with a physician, you don't know really. You don't know if they expect that the patient are coming back to be reinjected, or if they follow the patient regularly. So I'm not sure we know today what is really the duration of the clinic improvement. Interesting is also the cure rate. In the paper for Kazi, Khan and Schmidt, they tell that about 20 to 30, 40 patients will be cured. But except from the Schmidt studies, they do not describe the follow-up, so it might be that the patient has been just not wanted to be reinjected. So that was the study we performed with and we published in 2006. We observed that 85% was dry after the injection, and that this patient was not under anticholinergic. Which is also interesting because in only study, excuse me, I will come back now after. So if you are going to the, I'm sorry, I missed one. Yeah, I'm sorry. If you are going at the improvement of the clinical parameter, you see that the reduction of voiding per day is varying between 15 and 40%. But the only study with where the patient were stopping the anticholinergic drugs was the Flynn study and the Schmidt study. Incontinence, so which means this patient, despite of stopping anticholinergic drug, show a 50% have a 100% continence, and 85% at 100% continence. At least all of the study show an improvement in the incontinence episode per day, especially in the randomized control study. And as I told you before, in the 3 randomized control study, you have an improvement in quality of life. So, now I come to the main side effect, which is the post-void residual volume. At least if you look at the 3 randomized control, there was no acute retention. The residual volume was differently defined. In the size study, it was 150. In the Flynn study, it was more than 200. And the Brubaker study, it was more than 200 million. And you see that in the Brubaker study, 43 patients has to catheterize after the treatment. The problem is the significance of the catheterization, because as they could prove that patients after botulinum toxin who have to catheterize have a still improving quality of life as long as they have no UTI, which means it was more the UTI which was responsible for the loss of quality of life than the need of intermittent catheterization. So that's what we have on phase 1 study. That was the phase 2 study presented by Brubaker in the AUA 2009. It was also a study presented by Chappell at the AUA in 2010. The design was the same, and it was aiming at comparing in idiopathic overactivity and overactive bladder 50, 100, 150, 200, and 300 units of botulinum toxin. They integrate 330 patients that was idiopathic or AB symptom with more than 8 urinary incontinence per week, average of 8 or more micturition per day. But the urodynamic criteria as of this resolved activity was not required for dentistry. It was a 36 post-treatment follow-up, and the first control was a 12 weeks. They assessed the key assessment was the electrocardiography. Urodynamic was on investigator recruitment. Quality of life, post-residual volume, and that is, I find, very interesting because it was defined at pathologies more than 200 minutes, but only on investigational recruitment requirement, which means that this is a BS from the study. UTI and retention. The study has not been published yet. What they observed was the durable efficacy at dose of 100 and above, which means 1500 was not enough. 100 was efficient in the urinary incontinence episode. It was a dose relationship between the efficacy and the doses, but it was also a dose relationship between the 100, 200, and 300, and the risk of post-void residual volume. So they conclude that the doses of 100 and 150 units provide the appropriate balance risk ratio. And they conclude that minimally invasive treatment that may be offered consider benefit to patients with IORB and incontinence. So the phase 2 study is now finished but not published, so we're still at the point that we cannot give any recommendation grade. So I will jump to the neurogenic, this is more easy for me. That's a study we published in 2005, that was the phase 2 study. I don't want to you know the study, but what we found was the in spinal cord injury patient, if you inject the 300 unit botulinum toxin or the 200 botulinum, you have a significantly decrease in number of incontinence per day all along this, at each point after the study. The study was 24 weeks and we didn't observe any placebo side effect. And it was of the reason of this study that the ICI is to decide to put the botulinum toxin in neurogenic patient as a level of evidence 1 and grade B. But where are we today? The phase 3 study is finished now. The inclusion criteria was the same as the phase 2 study. The study is not published because the results are not analyzed, but if the phase 3 study confirms the phase 2 study, then we will get for reimbursement at the end of this year. So I find also two abstracts on the cost effectiveness from the botulinum toxin. This is a publication, this is an abstract. That was a T-year projection for actual cost in the UK in idiopathic detrusor activity using 200 unit Botox, but we don't know yet if it is a really adequate dosis. And the T-year projection cost for the projection for actual cost was about £10,000 if the patient has no comorbidity, £11,000 if the patient has comorbidity, and about £25,000 if the patient had to need 4 times to catheterization. But does the patient had to need 4 times catheterization if the residual volume is not symptomatic, and £27,000 if the patient has a comorbidity and need to be to perform clean intermittent catheterization. And for the neogenic bladder overactivity, the 10 years projection for actuarial cost was without comorbidity about £16,000. If you perform in a specialist center, £20,000, and usually you have to edit intermittent catheterization of the in this patient, which may make an amount of £32,000 if the patient has no comorbidity, and £35,000 if the patient have to be treated in a specialist center. The study on overactive bladder from Kelsey was differently. He make a projected quality of life improvement with more than 50% symptom improvement, and he assumed he found a potential cost for £6,000 per quality gain. But it is a BS of the study because the mean time to injection calculated by the Kaplan-Meier curve was 95 months, which is not the case, because in neurogenic detrusor activity, usually you have to inject a patient after 9 or 12 months. So I don't want to go to the mechanism of action. We speak yesterday. I think there is so many questions that I don't want to. I am not a basic researcher. I don't want to jump me. So it's not a research proposal, but it's a question which remain to be answered at the moment, because you, before you can put the botulinum toxin injection, at least in the idiopathic idiopathic detrusor activity or a non-neurogenic algorithm, we have to find if we can optimize the injection techniques, the number of injection sites. We have to think, I was speaking yesterday with somebody about where we have to inject. Did we have to inject the detrusor, the subutero, the trigon, the dome? Did we have to fill the bladder before we inject, or did we have to do it with empty bladder, what I found relatively difficult, because you have to see where you are. We have to find a benefit-risk assessment. You have to have a predictor of response, especially for my topic in neurogenic bladder, because we don't know why patients are not responding to the treatment. And we have to assess more in detail the duration of the response, in both in neurogenic and non-neurogenic detrusor activity. Mechanism of action we discussed yesterday. Are we working on the detrusor, the urotinium, or the suburotinium, or both? Are we working on the afferent pathway, efferent pathway, or both? Is it a direct or an indirect effect on the afferent pathway? Did we induce a neoplastic effect? Why 30% of the patient appear to be cured after treatment? We have to have more safety issue, especially diffusion in and out of bladder. I make the study in neurogenic bladder. I found that after injection we found about 28% of the injected fluid outside the bladder. We have to more look in detail at systemic subclinical effect, especially anticholinergic effect, proximal effect on the striatum muscle in the neighboring of the bladder, and we have to look at long-term histological bladder effect. So that was my part. So Apostolos.
So Brigitte carefully avoided my favorite issue, the mechanism of action of Botox, but I think I'm going to win this debate, if there is a debate anyway. So, start with neuromodulation is, in terms of sacral nerve stimulation, is an approved treatment, and Botox is not. And FDA approval for refractory urinary incontinence was 97, then for OAB 99. And actually there are, it appears that there are more than 35,000 implants worldwide up to 2008, which makes surprising why we have some little data in the literature in terms of numbers of patients. Another issue is the level of evidence. We have randomized trials, and there is no agreement whether it's a level of evidence 1 or level of evidence 2, actually, because the control is immediate versus delayed implants, and we don't really have evidence on a real placebo effect of neuromodulation. The results from this Cochrane review is that are in favor of neuromodulation for leakage episodes, decrease in number of voids, decrease in the degree of urgency in pad usage, increase in volume at first detrusor contraction, increase in bladder capacity, and also improvement in mental and physical scales. However, there is a problem that most of the studies all report always on not only on OAB but also on urinary retention patients. A good thing is that most outcomes slowly went back to baseline levels if the implants were turned off, and that could be considered probably as the placebo effect. What about long-term effect? This review from Emmanuel Chartier-Casselet shows that probably there is a decrease of efficacy with time in all in urgency incontinence and frequency urgency. I'm not going to talk about urinary retention. Whereas this one from Philip Vaccaro shows that it's a steady improvement up to 5 years after implantation. This is actually a case series again on 100 patients, and there is improvement of frequency which is sustained, and also improvement in incontinence is also sustained 5 years after implantation. What we need to know basically is what are the cure rates, how many patients that is are dry, and with in OAB wet patients 46% were dry up to 3 years after the implantation. In OAB dry patients 32% had restored frequency up to 2 years after treatment, while 69% had improved urgency. And in another review of case series, that's level of evidence 3, 39% of the patients were dry, 67% had more than 50% improvement. And in the NICE systematic review, which is again level of evidence 1 to 2, 3 or 5 years follow-up of 60% of the patients were either dry or 50% improved. So there is more or less an agreement on the cure rates. They pointed out that 33% of the patients had to be reoperated due to device site or infection related complications. And this is the a major issue, I guess, with neuromodulation. In ICI 2008, the revision rates were reviewed to be up to between 16 and 32%, and similar rates by 5-year follow up in 17 centers done by Philippa Carrowbrook again. The good thing, though, is that with the new implants, the new IPGs, it seems that their revision rate goes significantly down. And here you can see that there is been reduced to 1/3 of what it used to be before 95. And actually, in this analysis, you can see that it was almost zero revision to implant ratio rate in the last years of the study. So you wouldn't expect somebody from Greece to talk about cost effectiveness, but I'll do that. Is neuromodulation cost effective? It appears to be so. We don't have much evidence, actually, and much data, again, on urological applications. But in this analysis by Bolton and Harrison, the hardware costs only appear to be up to £8,400. And if you add another £5,000 for the battery only in 5 or 7 year revision rate, that adds up to almost £14,000. They haven't calculated the cost for the two-stage surgical procedure and hospitalization cost, but I don't expect them to be more than £25,000, well, much less actually. So it's probably similar or even less than Botox. And you would there's no measure of complication cost because this was actually an intended treat analysis, so it did include possible complication costs. But we do have studies, as you had earlier from Carl Dietrich, on fecal incontinence, and they have calculated that in the UK it's about £25,000 per quali gains, even less in Spain actually, €16,000 per quali gains. So if we project that to urology, then probably that tells you that's a cost-effective procedure. But what we need is studies on comparative cost effectiveness, and actually so far it appears that we only have abstract comparing sacral nerve stimulation with Botox. Two of them actually say that SNM is superior to Botox, the other one says that Botox is superior to SNM, so we need more data on that. What about neuromodulation in NDO? We don't have much evidence here. Actually, most of the evidence comes from SARS. We have some publications on SNMs, some on pudendal nerve stimulation, on peripheral tibial nerve stimulation, on IVIS, and on subthalamic cortical stimulation in patients with Parkinson's disease. All report good results, but they're not really controlled studies. The longest report is this one, on SARS, and we seem to have more evidence on SARS, which give good rates in continence, in full erections, in UTI-free periods, and the amount of patients using them, continuously using them, is very good. And in this seven-year study from the Netherlands, shows that 54% of the patients continue to be continent, and 68% had decreased UTI rates, and overall 54% had improved quality of life. So the long-term results are good. I think we initially, when we hadn't had a look at the time, we thought that we were going to discuss some considerations both about Botox and about neuromodulation. I'm going to go quickly through the considerations, and they can generate some discussion if you want. One is about gender issues. The majority of implanted patients are women. It's more than 80%, so that actually explains why we have such a low level of evidence in men's, such a low grade of recommendation from the ICI meeting in 2008. Another issue is that 30% of the patients actually fail stage one. And what is the reason for that is a discussion point. And another discussion point is why, if they pass stage one, 30% of them, the implanted patients, fail to gain benefit. And I've put some issues here that may explain or may need to be debated or may need to be further researched. How to reduce the non-responders? Would it be via prolonged test stimulation, bilateral versus unilateral, further improvement in technical issues such as the leads, the batteries, the angle at which the electrode goes in? Should we actually stimulate the S3 or should we stimulate the S4 in some patients? And how many of these things are we missing when the stimulation is done? Also, we need to identify efficacy prognostic factors which have not been identified either in Botox or in neuromodulation. It seems that, again, as in Botox, in neuromodulation, 50% of the patients do not get rid of the intrusive overactivity. I think that raises an issue whether is there a clinical significant intrusive overactivity or not. What can we do to have bladder-specific stimulation to avoid complications such as pain at the leg side or bowel complications? What about other forms of neuromodulation? Do we need to study better pudendal neuromodulation, peripheral neuromodulation, or brain neuromodulation, based on what you heard earlier by Carl Dietrich? Another issue is 50% symptom improvement clinically adequate? And if the placebo effect in OAB studies is as high as 40 to 50%, should we actually aim, as you heard before earlier today, for a higher percent improvement before we advance to stage two? And also, why is there a reduction of efficacy with time? Is it basically a technical issue? Is it because the battery starts wearing off? Or is it the placebo effect that starts wearing off, which we don't know about? And I think we need to look at the possible neuroplastic effect of neuromodulation, possible reorganization of neural reflexes, the brain control of the spinal reflexes, and the role of interneurons. There's actually some work here based on Griffiths and de Groot articles that actually point out to the role of spinal cord interneurons, where all those spinal reflexes seem to synapse, and actually Chet de Groot has proposed that that might explain why neuromodulation works both in idiopathic OAB and urinary retention. It might be that we have excitatory or inhibitory interneurons which change roles, and these roles are being switched back to normal after neuromodulation. And you heard about the differences between chronic and acute SNS, and which might prove there is a neuroplastic effect. But also, you heard about that in urgency incontinence there is change in activation of limbic regions and other regions which are involved in sensory motor learning. But also in older people, there is cerebral white matter lesions were found to be associated with diminished bladder control and increased activation of the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus. Could it be that we have brain-driven OAB, cerebral lesions, a cause of impaired control, while increased cingulate gyrus activation and attempt to cope with imminent loss of control? And if that's the case, should we identify central versus peripheral OAB, and should we have actually brain neuromodulation? So we did come up to some consensus with Brigitte. We need more long-term studies. We need larger patient numbers, we need crossover studies, we need cost-effectiveness studies, we need mechanism of action studies, we need to standardize basically the definition of efficacy. Should it be, should we still keep on going with this 50% improvement rate, or should we actually look at something different, and what do patients want as well? We need to identify prognostic factors of efficacy. I mean, we have been ongoing with neuromodulation for 15 years now, and with Botox for more than 10 years now, and nobody really knows what the prognostic factors are. We need a research on technical issues. You heard about the injection technique that needs to be standardized in Botox, and there's a lot to standardize in SNM, like technical complication, duration of test period, bi versus unilateral approach and device settings. We have in the new electrodes, there's four electrodes in the time lead, and we can play between anode and cathode, and we can change the device settings, and there's actually no comparative studies done to show what really happens if we change these. And also we need to have a benefit-risk ratio assessment. We were going to end up with saying where we stand so far in terms of guidelines and recommendations. I don't know if this one should be after discussion or before discussion. Shall I go ahead? Yeah, shall I go ahead with that then? So it's this is where ICI and EAU guidelines have, I think, the same algorithm for women. So in DO or in mixed continence, if initial therapy fails, then you can have botulinum toxin neuromodulation or bladder augmentation. I don't think the order is has been identified. But what about men? As you heard, the ICI 2008 gave only a greater recommendation D, so there's basically no recommendation. The EAU guidelines were braver, and they pointed out that we could have, if initial therapy fails in urgency incontinence due to DO, then we could have neuromodulation in men. And in terms of MDO, this is a bit, we cannot really understand what this meant, but it seems that neuromodulation, neurostimulation, you can have in either incomplete or complete lesions. I don't know if this goes first and to be followed by botulinum toxin, but our proposals for NDO patients would be that maybe Botox should go before SNM when patients in NDO patients that are already under CIC or with large PVR, as we have less data in SNM and there are a lot of technical issues such as need for repeat MRI as in MS patients. SNM could go before Botox in patients with preserved voiding and stable neurological disease, and also in comorbidities such as frequent erectile problems, which seem to benefit also from neuromodulation. And in idiopathic overactive bladder patients, I totally manipulated Brigitte and ended up to say that SNM should go before Botox at the moment because we don't have enough data on Botox. We have longer term studies in SNS, and there's all these factors that have at the moment act against Botox, such as unknown benefit-risk ratio, little evidence on repeat injections, unknown long-term effects. Despite the benefit-risk assessment, it appears that there will always be some danger for CISC after Botox treatment, even with a 100 unit dose. And also, what hasn't been said is that even those patients, 20% of those patients might need to continue on anti-muscarinics, which is, I think, not the case with sacral neuromodulation. Thank you.
So we're running a bit late, but we'll just curtail the lunchtime. Alan's had to check out of his room.
If you were going to do a randomized trial of idiopathic OAB patients, SNM versus Botox, you've gone through a lot of the benefits and pros and cons, but timing of primary outcome in such a trial is also a difficult issue because of the periodic nature of Botox and the more stable nature of the SNM. So do you have any advice about when you would want a primary outcome time period to be if you had all the money in the world and could do a randomized trial in idiopathic OAB between those two modalities?
First, I think it will be very difficult to make this study because I don't think that the company wants to compare. But no, I cannot answer. You mean what is the time to follow up?
Well, because the Botox starts to wear off, say it's 6 months or
but we
eight
don't
months.
Know. We don't really know the wear off effect of Botox. All the time it is in neurogenic patient it is up to the physician. Some physician repeat it systematically after 6 months. In my institution the patient is coming when he starts to have urinary incontinence, I restart anticholinergic, and then I prolong the effect for 12 or 14 months. In OAB patient, you don't know the effect. In the study where they reinject the patient, they do not tell you why they reject the patient. If they reject the patient because the patient is coming and asks for treatment, or are they reinjecting the patient because they objective criteria to inject the patient. So I think it is difficult.
Isn't also the main problem that the protocol for Botox is not known yet?
Yeah.
And we don't have the publication of the Brubaker study. So whilst an RCT is a very attractive concept, you wouldn't know what to put in the Botox arm at this stage for idiopathic overactivity, would you?
I thought Allergan finished their trial and they're recommending 100 units.
Sorry?
I thought that Allergan completed their trial and they're recommending.
They finished the trial. It was the first trial was Brubaker. The second one was a repeated trial, which was presented at the AIU. They emphasize that 100 is probably better, 100 to 250. But at the moment, they didn't publish the study. It's only an abstract. So.
Well, the paper is on the way. Mm-hmm. But, and as you said, the 100 will be the recommendation, 150, because the residual over 200 is later on the cause, that catheterization, and then we are running into the issue, do the patient need to catheterize or not? And that even was, as Brigitte already pointed out, depending on the physician. But I think your question is more or less answered with the algorithm proposed, as here on the last slide. It will be so difficult. When do you want to do the crossover? If you start with a Botox, and as Brigitte just pointed out, you do not know how long the duration is on the Botox, then you do not know when to cross over and when you will still have an effect for maybe the PNE or the SNM. So that is the first problem. And if you start, as here for the OAB patient, as you suggested, to start with that and then cross over, then you do not know if there is not like the bias from the first part of the trial. So I think to run a trial with a crossover is something like which is totally impossible.
But and you could run it without a crossover and do it for 2 years, say, couldn't you?
Then we are getting to the next point, as Anastasia pointed out. The question is, what is more cost-effective? Yeah. You cannot do it, to my opinion at least, and this is what the abstracts demonstrate, when they said that Botox is better compared to SNM, because they only looked into 2 years, mm-hmm. and you have to look into the long-term duration with comparing with the neuromodulation, because it pays off in the long term. Okay. So if you calculate that, that makes it very difficult to get something like that really to the point.
Tony.
Oh, I'll be very brief. I'll just ask a question of each. So regarding neuromodulation, the growth theory is kind of interesting, that it might involve stimulation of intramural parasympathetic ganglia. But, you know, they only constitute a small portion. Most of them are still outside in the pelvic ganglia. But if that's the case, you might just tell me why you think that might work. And if it would work, I guess bladder stimulation might be feasible, right?
Well, it's not really ganglia. It's into neurons somewhere by the spinal cord.
You were saying intermural in the bladder, right?
No, I said into neurons in the spinal cord.
I'm sorry. So then the second question I would ask for regarding the Botox, do you think that its injection is site-specific? In other words, if you inject it, does it not spread? You think it just stays very locally?
You mean outside the bladder?
No, when you inject into the muscle wall.
Yeah.
Do you think it's staying local at the injection site?
Would it come from the muscle into the submucosa? So even if you inject it into the muscle, would it come into the submucosa? If you inject it into the submucosa, will it go into the muscle anyway?
I think so. But I have no proof, but I think so.
You can see it actually. Well, you can see it when you inject it. You know, it's easy. You can see when you inject it, it spreads. You can see that there's sometimes there's a bleb in the urothelium. So actually, I think you can see that it spreads. Even if you inject the muscle, it spreads towards the urothelium mostly.
So
you can't really tell.
Site specific would be impossible.
But it's also going into the nerves. We know that already.
We saw a lot of questions that are still standing for neuromodulation. It may help for your report. There are a couple of manuscripts from our group that are currently under review addressing these things, and some of the main findings were cost-effectiveness. SNM becomes cost-effectiveness from the fourth year you started. So there was the American study that after 2 years, Botox was better. Well, in our model, neuromodulation becomes more cost-effective after 4 years. So in the long term, it appears to be more cost-effectiveness. Regarding unilateral versus bilateral, if you have a failure and you start then bilateral, we had 15 patients, 3 of them responded good of the 15, and of them, 2 are still using the device after 2 years. So it's not that good, but that's of course if they failed unilateral stimulation. And then the last thing was the device settings. We tested different frequencies, and for a whole group we didn't find any difference in outcome if you use another frequency. What you did find was in an individual you could increase the efficacy and reduce the pain, for example, at another frequency. So you can use it to modulate your effect, but as a group, as a whole, there's no difference.
John, he said it.
Just to add that the local situation of injections, I think there was a nice MRI study at the EAU showing that it goes everywhere, proven with gadolinium at an MRI.
That was my study.
Thank
Sorry?
You. Congratulations.
It was your study.
Yeah.
Good. Congratulations.
It was a very good study, wasn't it?
It was beautiful.
Yes. Are there any other questions?
Well, going a little bit into another field, into the end organ, and I think Carl Eric could maybe add something to that. Nobody can really answer. On the one side, what is a substantial change in the detrusor or in the sphincter from neuromodulation? And on the other side, we do not know, to be a little bit provocative, what does Botox effect in the CNS? Because something is normalized in the muscle for the CNS with a functional situation, so that would be very interesting to know. Maybe that's a way to study if, like in the long term, like after 6 or 3 months after Botox application, fMRI is done, and see what is happening there. And maybe this is comparable to what we have seen in the neuromodulation, but I don't know. It's just a question thrown into the crowd.
As I'm getting older, can I ask the last question? You mentioned that age seems to result in less efficacy for neuromodulation. Do the two of you agree? Is it the same with botulinum toxin, and do you agree with neuromodulation? The older the patient, the less good the effect with botulinum toxin?
We inject also older patients, but the numbers are too small. You cannot compare.
Okay.
But it seems to work, but if it is a difference, the number of patients is too small.
But I do not agree with the age. I said I question it.
Oh, you question it?
I don't have personal experience, but...
Okay. Time for lunch. Thank you very much, everyone.